Welcome to the People in the Red Vest, a podcast of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, the IFRC. I'm your host, Alexandra Sasha Goryshek, and in each episode, we feature inspiring, surprising, and thought-provoking conversations with people who dedicate their lives to helping others.
My motivation to continue and not give up came from different sources at different times. And sometimes it would be seeing especially volunteers and how much effort volunteers would put into solving various situations around the world. And knowing that they were doing it out of their own time and that they were doing it without taking payment for it. Maybe they would have their bus fare covered and they would get a sandwich or something, but generally just doing it because they believed in a cause was incredibly inspiring.
My guest today is Thorbjørn Pedersen. You are a goodwill ambassador for the Danish Red Cross and someone who actually made history by becoming the first person to reach every single country in the world for at least 24 hours without ever taking an airplane flight. Thank you, Thor, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is such an interesting and unique way of traveling. Why did you do it? What made you go on a journey around the world, which took a long time, and we'll talk about that later. But what made you do it? What is in your background? If you could just tell us what brought you to the point where you said, I'm going to take off and travel the world for an extended period of time without ever setting foot on a plane?
Well, it's a very, very good question. I generally answer it was a moment of insanity. But in reality, there are two different answers to the question. There's one, what was in my head in 2013. And then I reason in a different way today. Like, what was the value of what I did? But back in 2013, it came about because I've always been keen on adventure. I've always been keen on meeting people. I've been keen on traveling and seeing parts of the world I haven't seen before. I was born in 1978, and my mother's from Finland, my father's from Denmark, so there was a lot of back and forth between those two countries as a child. I grew up in North America for the first six and a half years of my life. So I was exposed to different cultures. Then I had school in Denmark, business school, and then eventually I found my way into the military, and the military deployed me to the Horn of Africa, where I was on a mission. And again, new culture and new experiences. And I came back to Denmark, and I found my way into shipping and logistics. And after about 4 years in an office, the company started sending me out. And I worked 2 years in Libya. I worked a year in Bangladesh and Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, the Arctic Circle, Greenland, US, around Europe. So I was exposed to more and more. And then in 2013, I received an email from my father, and I was reading and discovering people who had gone to every country in the world, which at the time was about 200 people had accomplished that, and found out that no one had done it completely without flying. And I was 34, and all my friends had their firstborn and were mowing the lawn and paying their pension and this kind of stuff. And I had met this wonderful woman, and I just bought an apartment, so there was nothing in the cards that I was going to do something like this. But I was infected with the idea and the ambition, and I just couldn't leave it. So slowly I started planning. I brought some friends on board, and we set a date, and on the 10th of October 2013, at 10:10 a.m., the project started, and soon after I crossed the border into Germany.
Traveling with other modes of transportation, everything, anything but planes, is one part of your journey. And another part, which is the reason why we're talking to you today, is that you visited National Society of the Red Cross and Red Crescent in almost every country or wherever there was one, really, everywhere you went. So how did that come about? And I also mentioned at the beginning that you were, for the duration of your travel, a goodwill ambassador for the Danish Red Cross. How did your connection to the Red Cross come about, and why?
Right. So I had 12 years of shipping and logistics within my life when we arrived in 2013. And I realized that for the most part, I'd been working on other people's projects. So if the phone rang and someone would offer me a job in, say, Libya, then I would say yes, I would sign the paperwork, I would travel to Libya and then complete the job and then look for another one. So in 2013, I was thinking, where do I actually want to work? And what kind of job security might I have in the future? And I thought about my time with the United Nations as a peacekeeper. And I had a search on the internet and thought, wherever there's conflict, wherever there's disaster, there's always going to be work. Unfortunately. And I figured maybe that would be my line of work in the future, that I would do logistics in hotspots around the world because that would be needed. And I looked at United Nations, I looked at Red Cross, I looked at a variety of different opportunities that I could follow. And with the Danish Red Cross, they were looking for a logistics delegate for the emergency response unit. And I read about the emergency response unit, the ERU, and I applied for that. And I had a meeting with the Danish Red Cross and my profile fit, and I started the training. And then throughout all of that, parallel, I started planning this every country without flying. And I got more and more serious about every country without flying and felt a little bit guilty because I was now almost fully trained as a logistics delegate within the Danish Red Cross. And then I realized there's room for a benefactor within this project. This is a massive undertaking. Potentially, I would become the first in history to reach every country completely without flying. And I thought this would take 3.5, maybe 4 years to accomplish. So we wanted someone to benefit from it. And it just made sense that it would be the Red Cross, given that the Red Cross had presence in basically every country around the world. So there had to be synergy between me going to every country and the movement being in every country or almost every country. That was my thinking. I approached the Danish Red Cross, and after some time, they decided to make me a goodwill ambassador and tasked me with writing an always present story about each national society around the world.
So you were telling me earlier that you wrote a blog in Danish for the Danish Red Cross, and then you switched to English. Mm. And for some time, we even, IFRC, hosted your stories, and then you started your blog. How did your writing start, and where are you now?
So when we were setting up the project in 2013, I had three friends that were supporting me, and one would do the website and make that look good. And it still looks like it would have been in 2013, so it hasn't followed the ages and the changes. One friend was really savvy with making it all look professional so that we could find funding for the project and potential project partners. And then this one guy, he helped start companies and or small organizations. And he said, forget about Facebook. Facebook is going to die. Facebook is topping and going down. What you want is Twitter and a blog. And back in 2013, I didn't have a Twitter profile, and I've never written a blog in my life. And I said, everyone was on Facebook back then. So I said, are you sure? And he said, yeah, forget about Facebook, just Twitter and the blog. So I was set up on this, and I left Denmark, and I was writing a blog. And in the beginning, I was visiting a new country every 25, 26 hours. So just the 24-hour cut. And I was blogging every day throughout all of this. Meantime, I was visiting national societies and doing interviews with maybe a volunteer, maybe a secretary general, maybe staff, maybe an ambulance driver, maybe security guard, anyone that I could speak to and get different stories and different perspectives about what it was like being within the Red Cross. Red Cross in the beginning, later on Red Crescent, and then so on. And these always present stories would be sent off to the Danish Red Cross, written in Danish with some photos from my visit, and then the next country and the next country. Meanwhile, writing these stories about who I met along the way, and did I take a bus or a train, and what was my experience, and everything that I thought had some value. So my personal blog got longer and longer and longer. So let's say in the beginning, it was a few paragraphs, and eventually it would be 4 or 5 fully written pages. And the longer I got into the journey, the more I would just be complaining. So you open up a blog and one page would just be me complaining about the circumstances. And then eventually it would be about human kindness or something interesting. So on. The Red Cross stories, or the always present stories, they were interesting in the perspective that I did not want to write the same story twice. But I was dealing with the same movement, the same 7 fundamental principles, the same morality. So I tried to look for, obviously, what the Red Cross does in Iceland does not necessarily reflect what we do in Denmark, because there are geographical differences. And in parts of the world, you have political differences, cultural differences. So I would always look for the uniqueness in the national society where I was. I was looking for the story. And I was writing these in Danish, and at some point it just got hard to sit across from a national society and say, I'm writing about you in a language you do not understand. And they're saying, what is it being used for and where is it going? So I started writing in English, and then I could share it with the national societies. And eventually I came across a wonderful woman, Kathy Müller from IFRC, and she said, we can use this. And then IFRC started using the stories for a while.
Are there any people that you met along the way, volunteers, Red Cross, Red Crescent volunteers, that whose stories inspired you or made you think that your journey was worthwhile, that you were encountering something good in the world and learning from it?
Certainly. My motivation to continue and not give up came from different sources at different times. And sometimes it was straight out of my engagement within the movement. Sometimes it would be seeing especially volunteers and how much effort volunteers would put into solving various situations around the world. And knowing that they were doing it out of their own time, and that they were doing it without taking payment for it. Maybe they would have their bus fare covered and they would get a sandwich or something, but generally just doing it because they believed in a cause was incredibly inspiring. In Central America, and I think Nicaragua, I was talking to this one guy who he himself was a volunteer, and he had the responsibility for more than 300 volunteers. And he made this Red Cross badge that looked like a New York City cop, like hanging around his neck, like Red Cross. And he was giving so many hours to his work within the Red Cross. And I just remember thinking, if this guy was working for a corporation somewhere and had the responsibility of 300 people, what kind of paycheck he would be taking. But this was humanitarian work, and this was out of his heart. So I think that was greatly inspiring. In Syria and Damascus, I met with an ambulance team, and they were so much younger than me, so much younger. They were around 20 years old, everyone in that ambulance. And the ambulance outside had bullet holes and dents, and it was dusty, and the tires looked worn. And they were telling me, we're running out of, like, we no longer have oxygen. we no longer have gloves, latex gloves. So really, we shouldn't keep going out there. But, and then the alarm went and they all jumped into the ambulance and they went into a war zone and with no guarantee of coming back. And that was incredibly inspiring to see some 20-something year olds with such a passion and such a dedication and no regard for their own lives.
I'm sure when you say no regard for their own lives, I'm sure with being on the road for such a long time in many different circumstances, were you ever in danger? Were you ever afraid?
Yes, I was. Yes to both questions. I had come to terms with that I might not come back home when I left home. I was hoping I would come back home. And I believed that there was more than a 50% chance that I would make it through alive. But I knew that I would be going to every country in the world with armed conflict. I would be going through countries with virus outbreaks. Just the even though most people are decent and busy with their own lives, I would be meeting thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And just within the vast numbers of a project like that, the risk would be there that I would run into someone who wanted to do me harm. So I didn't know for sure that I would come back home. Now, if we were to sit here and talk about all the bad things within the past 10 years, we might be talking for days. I have gruesome stories, and I've looked death straight into the eyes a couple of times. But in that perspective, if we were to talk about the good things, we would be talking for years. So just to say that, yes, there have been bad things along the way, but it's not representative of the world that I saw. Now, quickly, the headlines would be having cerebral malaria, and I could have been dead within a couple of days if not treated, but I did get treated. And it was a horrible time, but I got better, and I got stronger, and I was able to continue. Being at gunpoint in a jungle in Central Africa, far away from civilization, in the middle of the night, in front of three armed, uniformed men who were drunk out of their mind. The feeling of being lonely in that situation and the knowledge at the time that this is where it all ends. I will die tonight. I'm not going to die within hours. I will die within seconds or minutes. It was a situation. I've been through hundreds, if not thousands, of checkpoints. I've been around weapons plentiful. That's by far the most dangerous situation I've been in within my life. And I don't know how I got out of the situation. The driver and I were commanded out of the vehicle. And you have this dusty road that we're standing on. You have the warmth of the jungle around us. And you can hear crickets. And then the darkness of the night. And from the moment I got out of the vehicle, you could see hate pour out of the eyes of one of these soldiers. And you could feel the weight of hundreds of years of colonialism and problems and difficulties weighing down on my shoulders. And it was just the emotion, the drunkenness, everything. It made it incredibly dangerous. I stayed passive and complied, and it was a very long night, and was able to continue. When in the next 48 hours, my life was at risk another two times. So it was a rough time. Later on, a couple of years later, I was on the north coast of Africa within Libya, which at the time was highly unstable. I'd made it about 50, 60 kilometers across the border through checkpoints by the assistance of a policeman and a businessman. And I went for a walk on the beach. And I was told, you're fine, as long as you stay near the village, you'll be okay. And as long as people know you're with me, you're protected, and so on. So, but I was on my own, I was on the beach, and I walk, and then I freeze. Because up ahead on the beach, I see a dead body. And I remember my legs being like lead and locked to the sand. And my heart starts pounding, and there's a dead body in the sand in front of me. And then I convinced myself, no, it's not a dead. It's some plastic and some seaweed. It's too far away. You don't know. And then I walk closer, and then I freeze again. And there's a dead body rotting away on the beach. And I'm in this unstable environment. I know I cannot cross those two checkpoints without help. I don't know why there's a dead body in front of me. Everything is just circling around in my head. So I compose myself, and I start walking back to where I came from, and I discover another dead body. So now I'm between two dead bodies, and I really can't make sense of what's going on, and I'm frightened, I'm terrified in the situation. And I pass that body, and I walk on, and I find a third one. And then I also find some life jackets, and some tarpauling, and some driftwood, and I put two and two together and go, like, these were people who were trying to make it across to Europe. And their vessel was destroyed by the powers of the ocean, and they drowned and they washed up on shore. And before I left the beach, I found another two bodies. So I found five dead bodies. It took at least a year before I went into the ocean again. That year, about 220,000 migrants made it across the Mediterranean.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is really some story.
So three of the vessels I've traveled on board are confirmed to be at the bottom of the sea today. And you have this concept of vessels which are nicknamed soul sellers. And these are vessels that were in good condition at some point, and then they ran their lifespan, and then they were sold off and sold off and sold off. And every time they're sold off, there's less maintenance, there's less competence. They're ripped from anything of value, especially safety equipment and so on. So when you have a soul seller and you buy a ticket or you barter your way on board a soul seller, it's with the knowledge that the only way this vessel is going to end its life is at the bottom of the sea. It's like Russian roulette. You do not know if it's this voyage or next week or a year from now, but it will end up at the bottom of the sea. And the personnel on board are not trained to handle an emergency. Maybe the captain and a chief engineer are somewhat professionals. Everyone else is a cousin or a friend or someone who needed a job. And they're overloaded with people, overloaded with cargo. They go down fast. And three of them are today confirmed to be at the bottom of the sea. So sometimes you're in danger and you don't know. And sometimes you have a gun at your forehead and you know.
Well, I am glad that you made it out alive in all of those circumstances, and you're here to tell us these stories. You have lots of stories to tell, as the readers of your Once Upon a Saga blog can testify. You're also a keen observer of your surroundings, as we've already learned today. And you were also not just an observer, but also you partook in activities when you traveled. I know that you gave blood through the Red Cross 6 times.
Yes, correct.
Can you tell us about, I think Nepal was your first time. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So I reached Nepal and the Nepalese Red Cross, and was warmly welcomed. We took photos and we sat down and they prepared an interview, and I did my interview and tried to learn about their activities. And then at the time they were trying to promote blood donations. And they had a feeling that if a foreigner would donate blood, then the locals would also follow. So they sat me down in a chair and more photos, and I was given a sash that was put around my neck. And then I donated blood. So that was the first time. And then after that, I started to think, oh, in 6 months I can donate blood again, or in 3 months I can donate blood again. So maybe this is something I can do now and again. I already donated blood in Denmark, so I was familiar with it. When I stranded in Hong Kong during the pandemic, I found out that I could donate blood, and my blood was welcome, even though I had malaria. And they're very strict in Hong Kong, but they're also highly capable. So they just treat the blood in a different way, and it was fine. And I managed to donate blood 4 times in Hong Kong before I finally left. And then in Fiji, I also managed to donate blood once with the Fiji Red Cross.
Going back to Hong Kong, you alluded to the fact that this was during COVID,
yes,
the height of the pandemic. If I remember correctly, you were there for quite some time. Can you tell us about the experience there?
Yes, that's correct. So if we back up a little bit, I was good and ready to go home. 2 years into the project, I was worn to the bone. I was questioning, what are the true values? Am I achieving the goals? Trying to promote every country in a positive light, and trying to promote the people I meet, a stranger, a friend you've never met before. This is all good, and these are strong messages, but if I'm not reaching a large enough audience, is it worth the price that I'm paying? The work that I was doing for the Red Cross, this was good, but is it of any importance for the Red Cross that I reach every country without flying? Probably not. This doesn't stop humanitarian work. So where was the motivation in continuing? And I had this back and forth for years. And the project grew longer and longer and longer. And finally, I was down to the last 9. And I talked to shipping companies. And
The last nine countries
yeah, in the world. And these were all island nations, 7 of them in the Pacific, 2 in the Indian Ocean. And I talked to shipping companies. I had meetings with them in Singapore. And they were on board. And they said, we can have you home in 10 months. And I was, finally, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And then one of these shipping companies was supposed to get me to Palau, which is in the North Pacific, a small, beautiful island. And they said, we do not have the direct connection. We'll take you up to Hong Kong. And then you do transit for 4 days. And then we'll connect you with another ship to Palau. And I went like, that's fine. I did not need to visit Hong Kong. I counted that as a part of China, and I'd already been to China. But very happy to go to Hong Kong for 4 days if it got me to Palau. And then the global pandemic broke out, and I was eventually in Hong Kong for 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So 10 months was nowhere near.
No, nowhere near.
In fact, it took much longer than the 2 years.
It did. So the 2 years in Hong Kong was one thing, but at the point when I was able to leave Hong Kong, the pandemic had not been called over yet, which meant that most of the countries I had to go to still had their borders closed. These island nations in the Pacific were some of the last countries to open their borders. New Zealand, Australia included in those. The ships were not willing to take a passenger. They're generally not willing to take a passenger. They were making these exceptions for me. But now they were suddenly at risk of being quarantined if they got the virus on board. And who was going to pay in case they were quarantined? So they did not want to take me. So I lost my means of transportation, and I lost access to the countries. I negotiated with governments throughout the Pacific. And you can back up and say, who the heck negotiates with governments? And I successfully negotiated with 4 governments and gained access before they opened their borders, negotiated with shipping companies and found out how we could do this in a safe and proper manner, and got me to these countries during the pandemic. The Pacific on its own is hard to navigate. Even if you fly, it's hard to navigate. I was doing it without flying and during a pandemic. So that probably cost me another year.
Why did you decide that you would not fly? You said you made the connection with the Red Cross, and now you were questioning, was this doing any good to the Red Cross? Hmm. Why, if I recall, you said there were other people who had traveled the world, but no one that had gone around without flying. Was yeah. that the sole reason? Was there any climate component to the reasoning of not taking a plane? Why did you decide to make it harder on yourself?
Yes. The world has changed over the past 10 years. When I left home in 2013, no one assumed that I was doing it for the climate. No one assumed that. I had a few interviews. There was never a question that appeared. Those questions started to appear in 2015, 2016, as the world gradually changed. Today, 2024, everyone assumes that I did it for climate issues. But it was to be a historical project. This was the last dot on the planet. This was the last dark or white space, or whatever you want to call it. Something, the last great adventure. To be the first to do something that in some way had significance. And I've had plenty of time to go back and forth over what was the true significance in the project. And I think reaching every country without flying within itself is not truly the significant part. I think the values within the project, the promoting the movement, raising funds and awareness and connecting the movement in one journey, this has value. I think promoting people and promoting culture and countries within itself and becoming how do I want to phrase this? So if you imagine media, the way that media portrays the world, often you'll find it's negative. And what I was doing was trying to show a different point of view, and something that I truly believe is a more correct way to see the world, a more genuine way of looking at the world, a world where people are just people trying to carve out a little part of this planet for themselves and their friends and their family, where they feel safe and prosperous and give their children a better chance than what they had themselves. And this is TikTok dancing, this is going to school, going to work, following your favorite sports teams, listening to music, people being people. This is what I've seen around the world. So combating this image that was being generated by media, this has value. And then over the years, as the project got longer and harder, not giving up had value. Because this would inspire people around the world. This would inspire people around the world to pursue their dreams or whatever they had and what they were fighting for. And this could be family resolution. This could be education. It could be jobs. It could be learning to play an instrument or learn a new language or travel more, whatever. But I've received so many messages from people all around the world, from all the continents, saying that they were inspired in one way or the other. So all of this had value. Now, looking back, I'm very proud that the project has a very small carbon footprint. And today I'm trying to find different ways where I can have a more sustainable life, or I can be a little bit more green. I traveled from Denmark to Geneva by train. So this is one way of thinking, how can I do things differently? And I'm not a radical. I'm just saying we probably need to start thinking in this way. But it wasn't the reason behind why I set out. I set out because of the adventure, because of ambition, and to write my name into history.
To hear more about Thor's historic journey, tune in to the next episode of People in the Red Vest, to be released on April 23rd, 2024. This podcast was produced by Malcolm Lucard and me, Alexandra Sasha Gorishek, with production and engineering support from Damien Naylor. Promotion and marketing by Maxime Bouchard and Irina Ruano, graphic design by Valentina Shapiro, and web support from Cressa Qua. For
more inspiring stories, subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts.